Uncle Don here with the 300th edition of my Porcupine Petting Zoo on CFUR at 88.7 FM in Prince George, British Columbia. I thank Stephen Harper for postponing his budget announcement for an hour. I had this time slot first. Gordon Campbell was handed a welcome gift when Vancouver's Patolo Bridge, spanning the Fraser, caught fire. If this blaze was of human origin, then by the broadest of definitions, it could be classed as a terrorist act. The connection remains to be made between homeless people camping under that structure and the fire. If investigation confirms this, voila, these people have committed a terrorist act. Hearing such problems during the Olympic party, the public might accept the use of this fire as justification for temporary preventive detention of the city's homeless. We can't have terrorists roaming the streets and camping under bridges during that celebration. Of course, such roundups and incarceration would be challenged and found illegal, but not before all the jocks and tourists are safely at home. Apologies would be issued, perhaps some compensation granted, but Campbell's goal would have been achieved. He would have projected a squeaky clean image of his glorious city. After the festivities, it's back to the status quo ante, with squalor and hopelessness in the Lower East Side, out of sight and out of mind. Now that the Vancouver City Charter has been amended to allow unlimited borrowing for Athletes Village construction, City Council is seeking yet another alteration of the framework of rules. They want the power to enter private property without notification or warning to remove unwanted graffiti and illegal signs. Under previous rules, the city was obliged to give notice in a period of time for owners to remove illegal commercial signs or offensive graffiti. No such slack exists in the proposed charter amendment. If this gets past the legislature, we can expect some interesting photos as the stormtroopers swoop in to cleanse the civic environment of impure expressions. Would this new power be limited to the period when Vancouver seeks to project unity of support for the Olympics, or will this be a permanent change, constricting even further the rights of expression of their citizens? Barack Obama's inauguration speech warned Americans that they would have to pay for efforts being made to combat economic collapse. It was an echo of John Kennedy's plea that citizens ask what they could do for their nation rather than expect handouts from government. No such problem in Canada. Our government can go into deep deficit while average citizens are promised nothing but benefits, mainly in the form of tax cuts all around. Unsurprisingly, economists speak for our five major banks. Speaking for our five major banks, advocate reduction of taxes to stimulate business. Bank business. The public's being sold a bill of goods. All we have to do is cover all of the bank's bad debt and foolish loans, reduce their interest cost to zip, and give them free money, then all will recover and no one will lose. But a reduction in taxes isn't all they ask for. They want these cuts to be permanent rather than just until recovery. Their formula for balancing government revenue lost in taxes is, of course, to cut programs. Why should future well-to-do individuals have to pay off the debts accumulated in saving their bacon? Let those at the bottom relying on relief from poverty through minimum wage McJobs, unemployment insurance, welfare, and charity pay the bills. Gods forbid that bankers should be deprived of their limousines, Learjets, and multimillion-dollar bonuses. In this emergency, parasites are coming out of the woodwork, demanding their place at the public trough. If we ever pull out of this mess, don't expect any of them to form a queue to pay off the resulting debts. Pity the poor beleaguered petroleum companies now reeling under the pressure of lower world oil prices. They just can't squeeze any more from pulling it out of the ground, processing and selling it to us at the minuscule rates we pay at the pumps. These corporations need bailouts too, joining a line of supplicants reaching out of sight. Forgotten are the days when Exxon recorded the most massive profits in corporate history, followed closely by other majors. Also part of ancient history are the bonuses in the tens of millions for their executives. Why should we dwell on the past when losses are today's reality? Public sympathy in Prince George, anyway, has been tempered this last week when gasoline retailers raised their pump prices, in lockstep, of course, by 5 cents a liter. Zimbabwe has announced a new run of paper money in denominations of 10, 20, 50, and 100 trillion dollars. The $100 trillion bill was worth over 300 real dollars as of the date of issue, but with inflation at 231 million%, it rapidly joined its predecessors in the recycle bin. I suppose that one remaining export of Zimbabwe is its astronomical bills as curiosities for citizens of nations with modest inflation. For Canadians who think our countrymen and women are not up on federal politics, there's reassuring word from Frank Graves, president of ECOS, the polling firm. In a recent poll regarding political leaders conducted for the Globe and Mail, he stated, "Many Canadians don't know Michael Ignatieff very well, but they know he isn't Stephen Dion, and they know he isn't Stephen Harper." That was a direct quote. Rest easy, folks. Democracy is alive and well. Here in Canada, we face some of the same problems as our southern neighbor, but not so critically. One problem, or shall I say a situation perceived as a problem, is the portion of our federal budget locked into social entitlements. The United States has large fixed obligations in Social Security payments, Medicare and Medicaid for the retired, the elderly, and the poor. These payments go out like clockwork, entitlements embedded in legislation. In Canada, we have our own entitlements in our Medicare, Canada pension systems, and various social welfare schemes. Right-wing elements in both our countries profess that these entitlements cannot be sustained and must be reduced. Why, in the U.S., these three programs alone consumed 12% of their gross domestic product in 2006, with the country taking on mind-boggling amounts of public debt as a cure for mind-boggling accumulations of private and corporate debt foolishly accumulated. Servicing that debt must take funds away from social spending, so they say. Proponents of slashing public benefits have all the figures, and figures don't lie, but as they say, liars figure. While that 12% figure may be true, the money thus spent circulates through the economy and a good bit of it returns as taxes. As that 12% is recycled into the economy as entitlements, fully a third as much goes to the Pentagon, supporting the world's largest military. U.S. expenditures on its massive war machine are equal to all of the rest of the world's military spending combined. At a time when they have no credible enemy on the horizon, except perhaps the dreaded Iran and North Korea, both enfeebled, the U.S. has several naval fleets, each with aircraft carriers and dozens of support ships. It maintains over 700 military bases around the world and an air force with hundreds of bombers and missiles loaded with nuclear warheads and nothing to bomb. Surely they could cut short their foreign adventures in Iraq and Afghanistan, saving some billions that might support the sick and aged at home. Advocates of reduced government claim the U.S. Social Security system will begin to pay out more than it takes in by 2017 and will therefore be bankrupt. But what of the huge surpluses piled up over the years from the contributions of those now seeking retirement income? Where did that money go? Government over the years has used the Social Security account as a piggy bank to finance wars and preparations for wars. It's owed to the people who built that fund and should not be dodged. There is a way of covering money now spent on American medical care for the aged and poor. It would be the adoption of a universal single-payer insurance system on the Canadian model, eliminating a bloated insurance bureaucracy, the overhead of which eats up as much as half of all their spending on health care, while leaving many millions with no coverage at all. If taxpayers covered the same amount they pay now for private insurance and care, there would be slack to provide care for those now receiving it at government expense. You'll note that those who scream the loudest that social benefits must be cut are never those who rely on public help when distressed. They have their private medical insurance and retirement funds. They're the ones in the corporate world being bailed out with government money, money which is being borrowed from overseas and from domestic investors who will collect interest from future governments. Canadians are in a better situation, although we're hitched firmly to the American wagon. We've allowed our economy to become enmeshed in the U.S. one to an extent where Canadian governments, federal and provincial, are hamstrung in many respects. But our Canada pension plan is on firm ground, even though our leaders, in their wisdom, allowed a portion of the funds to be exposed to the current financial meltdown. We could well afford all of our social programs and more if we reverse the trend of allowing the rich, both individual and corporate, to evade fair taxation. Exposing overseas tax havens where billions are hidden, raising tax rates on exorbitant salaries, eliminating loopholes and taxing unearned capital gains at the same or greater rates as earned income would bring budgets into surplus, and we could emulate other nations taxing accumulated wealth. Finally, we would have to pull back from the failed system of unregulated globalization, as it does not work. We cannot allow manufacturing to flee offshore while relying on finance and resource extraction to support our economy. That's the road to third world status, and we allow it at our and our children's peril. When we hear all that claptrap about how we cannot afford to maintain our social services, remember the words of one Barack Hussein Obama, "Yes, we can." The Canada Mortgage and Housing Corporation is a crown corporation that issues insures eligible mortgages, thus encouraging banks and others to lend for homes. It's backed by the full faith and credit of the Canadian government. So far, so good. In 2006, our finance minister, Jim Flaherty, opened the field of home mortgage insurance to competition from foreign companies. Very clever. He sweetened the deal by guaranteeing their loans to the extent of 90%. The motivation for this opening and accompanying guarantees was purely right-wing ideology, ideology that hates to see a successful crown corporation. Those private insurers, both American, are Genworth Financial and the notorious American International Group, or AIG. They had shared about 30% of the Canadian mortgage insurance market until the current meltdown, when lenders abandoned them for the fully covered government agency. Americans cried foul. "Unfair to private enterprise," they screamed. Their answer to the situation? Increase the Canadian government guarantees to 100%. So let's take a look at this. A lender grants a loan to someone buying housing and pays a fee to an American corporation to insure that loan. If the borrower defaults, the lender goes to the foreign corporation for compensation. That corporation, under proposed rules, would go in turn to the Canadian government for full restitution to make them whole. What's wrong with this picture? With potential corporate losses fully covered by our government, what is the function of AIG and Genworth? They would take fees and provide no service except as conduits for government guarantees. This ceases to be a business and becomes a pure racket. Is this lunacy or just another way for our right-wing government to gut crown corporations while handing free money to foreign carpetbaggers? The answer is obvious. By removing the risk of defaults from both the lender and the insurer of loans, we open the door to the same kind of reckless credit expansion triggering the current financial collapse. It is terminally stupid. I resisted the temptation to include our number on the Canadian no-call list. I see that my procrastination was wise. A list of a couple hundred thousand names and numbers was assembled by the government and distributed for a $50 fee to telemarketers with the intention that they were not to bug these folks. There have been a flood of complaints by those on the list that they're receiving an increasing number of unsolicited phone calls. Call centers overseas found it profitable to buy these lists as they are cheaper than other phone lists available from commercial sources. They're also sure to be current numbers and names. Those calling from other countries are not subject to Canadian law, so all this government has done is to drive call centers offshore. Good going, Stephen. Well thought out. This is CFUR at 88.7 FM in Prince George. Remember how the Chinese dealt with protests during their Olympics? They established protest zones where individuals with special permits were to demonstrate out of sight of participants and spectators. People who applied for permits were arrested and the protest zones remained empty. George Bush's Secret Service used the same tactics whenever George appeared in public. Protest signs and protesters had to be out of sight and hearing of the free world's leader, and freedom of assembly be damned. RCMP Assistant Commissioner Bud Mercer has taken those lessons to heart. He said, quote, "We have an obligation and a responsibility to support and facilitate lawful protest, and we'll do everything we can to do that." He went on to declare that the Integrated Security Unit overseeing law and order at the Games will attempt to facilitate free and democratic protests. This may include the setting up of protest zones. You can bet that sanctioned zones will be out of sight and sound of any Olympic function. Herein lies an opportunity for local development. All we need to do is have Prince George declared a protest zone where disgruntled citizens will be free to demonstrate, march, scream, shout, and protest well away from any opportunity to inconvenience the magnificent Olympic party. Here we could assemble all of those embarrassing misfits from Vancouver and folks who find this silly exhibition of physical prowess offensive. Just think of the economic stimulus to our community. Last Friday's Prince George Free Press carried an article bemoaning the fact that local first responders, that is our cops, firefighters, and ambulances, are ever more confronting people in crisis with what we euphemistically call mental health issues. You know what that means. Ever since governments determined that individuals with issues should no longer be hidden away in institutions, they've made it most difficult to take people into protective custody for their own and society's protection. This was not prompted by any concern for the mentally ill, but strictly for financial reasons. Initially, at least, it saves governments money to shutter institutions, turning the perpetually confused, the person responding to the voices, the suicidal and others previously in care, loose with a handful of pills and a handshake. The bills don't disappear, but resurface in policing costs, the courts, the jails, and hospital emergency wards. Without implying any connection to my immediate previous comments, I noted another article in the same copy of the Free Press. The subject of this piece was a resident of the North some 20 years ago when she was traveling south on Highway 97 with a group of friends. Their car was shattered by an alien spaceship which caused them to stop south of Hundred Mile House. The other occupants of the car were put in a trance while the subject was escorted to a mothercraft. Therein, she was shown home movies of the Earth's future calamities. The alien spoke to her telepathically, saying she had been chosen to warn humans of the dangers awaiting our planet. She told the reporter that she was picked because her soul, quote, had already chosen a conducive path. Don't look it up, it's not in the dictionary. Besides, her family has a psychic strain and her father has unelaborated abilities. Now, I don't doubt this lady's story for a minute, nor do I think the article is just publicity for her book. This was in the Free Press, so it must be true. But I question her judgment. Who among us hasn't been kidnapped by bug-eyed, stubby aliens and taken aboard flying saucers to have our nether orifices probed? We know that flying saucers exist, but the fact is suppressed by complicit governments. What stands out from this report is that she has gone public with her tale. That is, in my estimation, unwise of her. I never tell people about my abductions or the telepathic conversations I have with aliens from other dimensions. Do I want people to think I'm nuts? Those of you with conducive souls will understand. Canada's in recession, but not all businesses are suffering. Religious entrepreneurs are capitalizing on fear and uncertainty, guiding victims to spiritual retreat from reality. Yes, churches which had languished during the good times are swelling again. President Obama's mantra of hope is extended beyond this life to promises of rising stock markets and resuscitated pension funds in the hereafter. Well, any port in a storm, and you can believe what you want, but I still hold that pounding the pavements with a good resume beats warming a pew when it comes to finding a job. Likewise, when it comes to strife at home, a preacher may give good advice, but keeping domestic peace requires more cooperation and understanding than prayer. Times of trouble are more easily navigated when we have friendly companionship, but why haven't we more secular ways of cooperating? Why do we need to congregate in organizations centered upon dubious and unprovable doctrine? I think that an hour of work with a congenial voluntary organization beats an hour of attendance at church for soothing the soul, but that's just me. If it makes you feel good, go for it. Just because the Vatican only recently and begrudgingly admitted Galileo was right that the Earth is not the center of the universe doesn't mean the Church is not up to date with technology. As they have previously communicated with the faithful via radio and television, so now they expand. Facebook hopes a papal page, fan page, to which some 25,000 faithful or curious subscribe. Twitter has three accounts supposedly belonging to the Pope of Rome. And now, ta-da! The Vatican has opened a channel on YouTube. There one finds daily postings of news clips and videos with text and spoken word and in four languages. Sorry, no Arabic, that's Al Jazeera. Now, according to Vatican spokesman, people can explore and express their religion spiritually and their faith online. Maybe it's something that can be done while you're working on your resume. Not all of the doctored heirs sitting in pews are expressing their faith online. Some are out picketing and demonstrating against Barack Obama's decision to rescind George Bush's restrictions on a woman's right to choose. Expect our local advocate to be out on by the hospital on 15th Avenue with his anti-abortion sign again. Tens of thousands of women's rights opponents assembled on the National Mall last week to protest the audacity of Obama in restoring funding to worldwide organizations daring to advocate that abortion is a woman's right. Better to have them on the Washington Mall than in the White House. It seems that we are so involved in that war against Afghanistan that we never question the core function of Canada's armed forces. It's axiomatic that a non-aggressive second- or third-rate nation like ours maintains a military to defend its territory against hostile acts. The Army protects our land borders, the Navy patrols our seacoasts, and the Air Force defends our skies. Simple. But barring overt hostile actions or potential invasion, what should our forces be doing? They might undergo constant exercises and training for repelling enemies, or they might look further afield, participating in aggressive wars to appease foreign leaders. This is the function our forces are serving now, demonstrating our fealty to the only potential adversary with the means to invade and defeat us rapidly and decisively. We help with their heavy lifting, sacrificing Canadian soldiers and resources in service to the United States of America's former president, the disgraced George Bush. George Bush the Lesser has returned to his beloved Texas and good riddance. His country is engaged in a massive readjustment of goals, among which should be a reappraisal of America's ongoing wars. And so should Canada, if not bogged down with a minority government of lickspittles. Their foreign masters have changed, and it's time for us to change with them. Instead of sending our troops to a country where they're not wanted and are violently resisted, we might dispatch them to areas where they would be appreciated. We could at least try to alleviate problems threatening to explode in our backyard. Peacekeeping operations where threats and hatreds fester could be preventive self-defense, saving Canada and the world from future conflagrations. Although Sudan and Congo deserve attention, I cannot think of a more explosive situation than that in Israel-Palestine. This is a petri dish in which hatred is the culture. The parties cannot solve their differences, so it's time for international intervention to do it for them. Everyone pays lip service to a two-state solution, and most agree that the pre-1967 border should be restored. So let's do it. We cannot count on the United Nations or NATO to take action, as both are subject to American veto, and that country, even with Obama at the helm, seems to be enthralled to the State of Israel endorsing its every action. So a new ad hoc coalition of the willing might be formed. We might not expect American participation, but we could ask that they not interfere. Canada has experience in peacekeeping, having accomplished a nearly impossible feat of keeping Greek and Turkish Cypriots off each other's throats for decades. That might serve as a template for settlement of the Israeli-Palestinian mess. It would take more than persuasion to get Israel to withdraw from Palestinian territory, tear down the apartheid wall, and dismantle their colonies. It requires a coalition that would tell Israel, Tina, there is no alternative. Resistance would meet serious, concerted international force. If Israel were surrounded and bereft of the American aid that kept it afloat, they might acquiesce, especially if our forces guaranteed their borders and security. Of course, that would have to be reciprocal guarantees to Hamas and Fatah tied to their recognition of Israel and cessation of rocket attacks and suicide bombings. With borders secured, our next step would be the disarmament of both sides. Therein lies a real job. Israel would have to be stripped of nuclear weapons, weapons they deny having. It will be this task that is key to maintaining peace in the Middle East. As long as Israel has the bomb and its neighbors will attempt to develop or acquire their own. After disarmament will come the bigger job, convincing the nuclear powers that it's finally time to pursue the total worldwide nuclear disarmament promised in the Non-Proliferation Treaty. So how's that for a goal? Total nuclear disarmament and separation of warring parties worldwide, starting in the Middle East. Elect me Prime Minister, and I will accomplish this and more in my first term, or my name isn't Rumpelstiltskin. While the world is overflowing with goodwill toward Obama and the new administration in Washington, might this not be a good time to forgive and forget? I just wonder if that new Washington crew, busy as they are saving the world's financial empire, might not notice if we exercise some compassion for those of conscience who fled the U.S. Armed Forces for Canada. During the Vietnam War, we accepted immigrants from America without regard for their employment status, and it seems that we are the richer for it. We could do it again. We might narrowly define desertion only as running in the face of fire, something which none of today's refugee claimants has done. We could consider those resigning from the military not as deserters, but as guilty of no more than breach of contract, which is no criminal offense. And to be consistent, we had changed our rules allowing any of our own forces, at least those not in combat operations, to resign with due notice. It benefits no armed force to have within its ranks those who are disgruntled. Soldiers lacking a belief in the righteousness of their cause are liabilities. For the benefit of those individuals, for the forces, and for society, they should be released. To grease the wheels in Washington and combat opposition to our taking dissident Americans resigning from their forces, we might sweeten the deal. We could offer to provide haven for current reluctant residents of Guantanamo who cannot be returned to their native lands. Those in legal limbo have to go somewhere, and Obama's in a quandary as to where to put them when the concentration camp is closed. I don't see why we wouldn't have room for them. After all, we do still hold that a person is innocent until proven guilty, don't we? Although I was a veteran at the time I immigrated, having completed my whole enlistment, I was in the midst of a flood of men crossing the border to avoid conscription into a war they considered immoral. Having no roots here and not knowing where to start in settling in, I visited the offices of the Toronto Anti-Draft Program. There I met a frenzied staff of volunteers confronted with a steady stream of Americans new to Canada who had no option but to sink roots here. One volunteer I remember particularly was Naomi Wall, a Quaker woman who sought the jobs for new immigrants. She labored tirelessly, pulling strings, calling in favors, and dogging employers to get men placed. And there was Dennis Duffy, a professor at the University of Toronto, who took in men with his young family until they could find quarters. He was kind enough to allow me to stash some of my gear at his place while I found a home. These and many others worked tirelessly to help men who were sometimes frantic. While I was in the TADP office, a man came in who arrived with nothing. He had actually run across the border, pursued by the FBI, until he reached Canadian soil. You can imagine his mental state. Actively supporting the Toronto Anti-Draft Program's work was the local Canadian Friends Service Committee. I cannot say enough for the good that these Quakers have done and continue to do faith. While I routinely criticize organized religions, you will never hear a bad word from my mouth about the Quakers. This concludes the 300th opening of Uncle Don's Porcupine Petting Zoo on CFUR at 88.7 FM in Prince George. There's a closing thought. Is it probable that everything to happen will be probable? Here's another. It is better to light a single fuse than to sit and curse the darkness.